20, Ruth identified Boaz, Naomi identified Boaz to Ruth as one of our near relatives, or the word is one of, he's a redeemer. So that made us think that she's already thinking along these lines of security for Ruth. And so she instructs Ruth, this is the beginning of chapter 3, on how to approach him. He's at the threshing floor, and asks him to perform the duties of the near kinsman. And she does that by uncovering his feet. And then when he awakes, she requests that he spread his skirt or spread his covering over her, which for all intents and purposes was a marriage proposal. She was asking him to perform the duties that the law mandates in terms of being the nearer kinsman. And where we closed on Wednesday, there's the citations from the law, as well as a reference from the prophet Ezekiel, where God is referring to Israel in terms of a marriage, in terms of a relationship along those lines, and he uses that phrase, covered you with my cover, or covered you with my skirt. And finally, in verses 10 and 11 is where Boaz commends Ruth for not chasing after younger men. So that tells us that Boaz was somewhat older than what ordinarily might have been Ruth seeking a husband, and also for her good reputation that the city already knew about. So this is where we pick up in verse 12 of chapter 3, and this puts us at the bottom of page 47. Boaz is agreeing to redeem Ruth, but I don't want to say there's a problem, but there's a legality to work out. What's the issue? Well, okay, how to make it legal? How are we going to make it legal? All right, there's somebody else, isn't there? Who was the? I mean, the law said it had to be the nearest kinsman. Is Boaz the nearest kinsman? No, there's one that's nearer than him, and so by all rights, the nearer kinsman has the right of first refusal. I don't want to make that sound bad. It wasn't just marrying Ruth, but it was also that fact of purchasing the property that belonged to the deceased, and so the nearest kinsman had the first right to that. Now, if he passes, which of course he's going to, but if he passes, then who's next in line? Well, it's Boaz. So I think we can commend here Boaz is being careful to do what? Yes, he's going to follow what the Scripture, he's going to follow the steps that the Scripture lays out for the Jew in that particular matter. So there was a nearer kinsman, and he had the first right, and if he chose to redeem Ruth, in fact, what did Boaz say to her? Verse 13, if he will redeem you, well, good, let him do it. That's the way it's supposed to be. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Then he tells her to lie down till morning and get some sleep. And that was pretty much the end of their discussion along those lines. Now, there's something else that happens at the end of this episode in the threshing floor that protects Ruth's reputation. Verses 14 and 15. Morning comes, and if she just gets up and goes back to Naomi's house, what's the potential problem? Somebody see her. Now, let's ask the obvious question. Have they done anything wrong? Was it anything illicit about what? No, not anything at all. But what is Boaz still conscious of? Reputation. People may talk. People may think if they see her leaving and then they see him leaving, minds can go in a place that they shouldn't go. And so to help protect or to help further protect her reputation, what does Boaz do? Look in verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning. This is chapter 3, verse 14. Lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. It's still dark outside. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. It's not that he's ashamed that they've done anything wrong. He's just being careful to protect her reputation. Again, he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she had some wrap about her. And then what did he do? Verse 15. All right, he gives her more barley. He fills it up. Mine says with 6 measures of barley. I don't know how big a measure is, but it was some quantity, and has her carry that back to give what impression? Well, but she's coming back with the grain as if she'd gotten an early start to her day's work, which she is taking grain back for her and Naomi, so that there's nothing dishonest about that. Okay, and it would be a sign somewhat to Naomi that she did talk to him, and Ruth, of course, is going to tell Naomi all that's happened this evening. So she carries it back. Verse 16, she came to her mother-in-law, that would, of course, be Naomi, and she said, "How did it go?" And so Ruth tells her all that she and Boaz had talked about. Then verse 17, and he said, "Take these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed." So again, he's providing for them in a manner of speaking. So back in chapter 2 and verse 11, and then earlier in this chapter, he had already commended her for her good name, hadn't he? She's known well throughout the village or the town among the people. And he would do nothing to dishonor that now. And even though, again, we say nothing bad has happened in this meeting, but for the appearance that it might give to for her to go back and then him being seen leaving the threshing floor, others might talk. Others still might talk seeing her leave, and so he lays this grain upon her, take it back to Naomi. All right. I want to bring this out. This is top of page 48 now, and I didn't put this into the material, but I got this information, and I thought it relevant here. What is the overall depiction of the times in Israel right now? The days of the judges. Spiritually? Yeah. Idolatry, chasing after gods. And what was some behavior? Historians tell us of some behavior that was very prevalent among the pagans and their idols, especially during harvest time. Fornication was rampant. They would give thanks to their gods, the fertility gods, for the good crops and the good reaping that had come out of the fields. And so part of the celebration of those idols would have been fornication. Would it surprise us that some of that's going on in Israel during these days? No, because of the low spiritual times we have been reading about in the stories of the judges. So it seems to me that Boaz is being very careful that they set the right example before others and nobody get the wrong idea. Fornication was rampant among pagan religions. It was a way to worship the fertility gods around harvest time. And so even though Boaz and Ruth didn't do anything wrong that evening, they still were careful to avoid the appearance of sin. That's a good lesson for us, isn't it? What did Paul say to the Thessalonian Christians? Chapter 5, verse 22 of the first letter. Abstain from every form or every appearance of evil. Well, that's what we need to do. If it even looks or smells like it's questionable, we've got to always live above board and set the right appearance, and set the right example. So I thought that to be a good New Testament. Well, that's true. Yes, that's correct. All kinds of evil practices. Sodomy, fornication, idolatry, adultery. Okay, yes, all kinds of immoral sins. Absolutely. And so here's a good man, here's a good woman, and they're trying to work things out as the law would dictate, the levirate marriage and the kinsman redeeming the widow. And in the midst of their discussions that they had, they wanted to make sure that nobody got the wrong idea about what they had done. Again, even though nothing wrong had happened, they were being extra careful. And I just think that's really, really commendable. So verses 16 and 17, again, Ruth returns to Naomi and tells her about her meeting with Boaz. And something else in verse 18, the last verse of chapter 3, what does Naomi tell Ruth about Boaz? Not just that he'll take care of it, but what else? He's not going to rest. He's not going to procrastinate. He's not going to linger. He's going to get right on it, right? He's going to see to this duty because it's important. Yes, verse 18, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today." No negligence, but diligence in duty. Does the Scripture encourage God's people to that kind of work ethic? When something needs to be done, we need to get right on it. There's no benefit gained in delaying and procrastinating. When something needs to be done, then that's what we need to do. And Boaz certainly shows that good characteristic. Okay, anything else through chapter 3? All right, chapter 4. This is the marriage. The redemption takes place between Boaz and Ruth. This gets us now to page 49, the last lesson, lesson 21. Well, Naomi had told Ruth at the end of chapter 3 that he's not going to rest, and Naomi was correct. As chapter 4 begins, what does Boaz do? All right. Now, Brother Lambert, tell us what's important about the gate, the city gate. Okay. Any legal issue that had to be settled, the parties appeared to have come to the city gate. Who else would be there to sort of act as arbiters? All right, the elders of the city. Verse 1, verse 2 says that. But who is the first person Boaz contacts? All right, he contacts that nearest kinsman. And he says, you come and sit here by me. We've got something to talk about. So he calls him to the city gate, and then also you'll see that he calls 10 city elders as witnesses. Now, for the record to say he called 10, was there more than 10? Well, I guess it would be, but he just called 10. That would be enough to bear record or be witness. And he asks them to sit down as well, and they do. So all the parties are present now. What's Boaz start right in on? What's he say? Verse 3. Okay. He says, Naomi. Now, notice he doesn't start with when Ruth needs a husband. That's not what he says. First thing he needs to decide is Naomi's got to sell the land. Naomi has land to sell that belonged to her husband. Verse 3. Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. Indicates that Naomi is in need, and she's got to sell the land. And him saying that obviously is pertinent to this man, because in verse 4, what does Boaz say next? All right, I'm telling you this because you're first in line. You're the nearest kinsman. You have, again, the phrase I'm using is you have the first right of refusal. And if you're going to buy it, then all right, that's the issue before us. And if you're not, then I need to know about it because I'm after you, and we're going to have to follow this thing according to the law. So that's verse 4. I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. Well, how did the nearest kinsman respond? Yes. I'll buy it. Now, again, what hasn't he mentioned? Not mentioned. He just mentioned the land. Boaz is not setting him up. He just hasn't mentioned Ruth yet. Buy the land. And the man is very willing to buy the piece of property. Well, after he agrees to buy it, then what does Boaz say? All right, if you're going to buy the land, Ruth comes with it, basically. This is verse 5. On the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. That's what the law said, wasn't it? Boaz is trying to enforce what the law taught. So if you agree to buy the land, which that's your right to do that, and really it's not just a right, it's the duty of the nearest kinsman. There was a situation, and we'll see the text from the law just in a moment, where the nearest kinsman could refuse, and obviously this man's going to refuse, but Boaz is giving him that choice. So verse 6, after he mentions Ruth, what does the nearer kinsman say? I can't do that. And does he give a reason why? Yeah, what was his reason, Doug? Yeah, he says in verse 6, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Now we'll stop right there in verse 6 for the moment. I can't do it. It's gonna hurt me and my inheritance, my heirs, if I do this. Now I've asked the question, this is the second part of question 2 on page 49. The King James says, I would mar my own inheritance, or other versions, I would ruin or jeopardize my own inheritance. In what way would him redeeming this land, and they're following the dictates of the law, how would this ruin his inheritance? You thought about that? Yes. Well, I think you're on the right track. If he marries Ruth, which he's supposed to, if he redeems the land, that's she goes with the package deal, if you will. Then also his job is not just to buy the land and not just to marry Ruth, but then also do what else? Got to raise up a son in whose name? Mahlon, or Ruth's first husband. That's the way the law read. And so that his name not be blotted out from the records in Israel. Well, now that that heir would be born, who would eventually become the owner of the land? This son born by this kinsman and Ruth. So any money right now that this man's going to spend to buy that land, eventually, does he get to keep the land? No. So see, he's lessening his own inheritance to buy land that he will get to keep eventually anyway. It's going to go to someone else. So did he have other heirs? Well, was he married? It doesn't say. I would like to think that he was not, because we know the Scripture always encourages that it's just one man and one woman. But there was polygamy, of course, in Israel. So be that as it may, whether he was already married or not, he had no children, or he had already a bunch of sons. This land, if he bought it and married Ruth and raised up the son in Mahlon's name, then that land would eventually go to Ruth and her son, he wouldn't get to keep. And so he saw that as a way to jeopardize his own financial holdings. Therefore, he says, I cannot redeem it. I don't want to jeopardize or mar. Other word was what? Ruin. The New King James says ruin. I don't want to ruin my own inheritance. So he's approaching this from what perspective? How about a financial standpoint? I mean, he sees it. This is not going to be in my best interest financially to redeem this land, because it's going to hurt my, I don't use the word portfolio, but it's going to hurt my current holdings if I buy land and don't get to keep eventually anyway. So he refuses on that basis. Money that's already his and would be eventually his estates would be used to purchase land he would not eventually get to keep. So Ruth, and really her son that would be born to this marriage, would be the eventual owners of this land. And he recognized that, he saw that, and so he opts out and says, I don't want to buy it. And he refuses. Now, look at this, that we answered question three as well, how Ruth was destined to become the owner of the property. It's because of the son that would eventually be born, or hoped to have been born, through this levirate marriage. Now, there's a custom that had to be done when this transaction would come about and someone refuses. Now, if he had agreed to do it, then it's a done deal. But since he refused, starting in verse 7, now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. What was the custom? They would swap shoes. It says in the middle part of verse 7, a man removed his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the manner of attestation, or to attest, witness the refusal. So verse 8, the closest relative said to Boaz, you buy it for yourself. And then what did he do? He took off his sandal. Now, it doesn't say he gave it to him, but I think that's the custom that we're talking about here. All right? Let's look for a minute in Deuteronomy 25. Let's hold our place here in Ruth 4. Turn back to the law, and let's read a section of the law there that it seems to have some bearing or some connection, although it's not exactly how it worked out here in Ruth 4, but there's some indication from this statute in Deuteronomy 25 that seems to be coming out in the story here. Deuteronomy 25, and we're going to jump in at verse 7. Well, that's where I've got it on the charts. But let's read verses 5 through 10. Norm, if you've got that for us, would you read Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10? Now, that didn't exactly happen here in Ruth 4, but there is some similarities, aren't there, to what the law talked about here and what happened here in Ruth 4. There's no spitting in this man's face, but has he refused to perform these duties? All right. The first thing, again, Boaz said was buy the land, he was willing. But when he brought up, if you want the land, you've got to marry Ruth to go with it, that's when he refused. So this removing of the sandal seems to be some connection back to this statute in Deuteronomy 25. If we just look at the passage that Norm just read, do we have any idea of God's expectation when a woman was widowed and she had no son? Was there a divine expectation for her to marry the nearest kinsman? Yes, that's what that passage states in the law. So God expected that to take place. If he refused, then he was to be treated that way as what Moses wrote back in Deuteronomy 25. Now, in this situation, back here in Ruth 4 now, again, it's not an exact parallel, but that seems to be some connection back to that statute. He's removing his sandal as witness. I have no desire to marry Ruth. And then, so Boaz, you get it for yourself. And then. Yes. The question is, would it be less punitive if he's not a brother? Because the passage did say brother. That passage, did brother literally mean sibling? That's the way it reads to me. But also, sometimes brother can refer to a relative or a kinsman. What we're reading here, especially in Ruth 3, the third chapter, and again, Naomi's words in verse 20. Naomi recognized him as a close relative. Cousin, just a national brother, if you will, from the tribe of Judah. So, I don't think we can say that the fact that that passage said brother, we must restrict it to siblings. What if he had no siblings? Then you've got to go farther down the line and find the nearest person, the nearest kinsman, to perform those duties. But I think that's a good observation to make. Yes, Doug? Of what chapter? Of chapter 4 of Ruth? Yeah. Yes, okay. Right, and that part does harmonize with Deuteronomy 25, that the sandal was removed and given to the one who was now next in line to perform those duties. So here's the custom, and it's not just a custom like, well, we sort of thought this up. No, there is some connection back to a statute in the law where this was to take place. But I just bring up this passage in Deuteronomy 25 to say, with that being in the law, there seems to be, well, not seems, I think we can say, God had some level of expectation for the nearest brother slash kinsman slash relative, if in that situation, to step up and take his deceased relative's place, marry the widow, and raise up children so that his name not be forgotten or blotted out in Israel's records. No. Mm-hmm. Okay. He could be a widower himself, never had married. We don't know his situation, is not revealed. So if he had other heirs, then his holdings would go to them. This would start sort of a new line through Ruth for this son that was to come up. Again, I think your point's good, Freddie. He's not worried about the implications of marrying Ruth. He's willing to redeem her. This nearest kinsman, though, wanted the land, but not bad enough that he had to marry Ruth to get it. He's opting out at the time. Yes, whoever got the sandal, you give it to the next one in line if you're refusing. But again, back to this passage, there seems to be some shame attached to removing the sandal, spitting in the man's face, who would say, I'm not going to do it. Wouldn't that be awful to get spit in the face? I mean, that's just awful. But that's what they were supposed to do. And thus his name would be, the passage says. So it was a dishonorable thing. Again, here in this episode, there's no spitting. He removes his own sandal and says, here, I'm passing it to you. I'm out. I don't want to pursue it. Yes, Charles. Could be. Yes. Those are good points to make. I think what we can say and all agree on is that Boaz is being extra careful to follow the exact dictates of the law. Whoever is, it's agreed to that this man was closer than him, so he had to go first. And Boaz is recognizing that. Him refusing, which if Charles's point is true that Boaz was actually a literal brother, then so was he. Would have to mean that, or it could just mean brother in the sense that he's our kinsman of the tribe of Judah. However it works out, it was determined and everyone knew this man was first. I'm second, and he has first right. He's refusing. Then let all present here know, all these witnesses. I'm stepping up and I'm going to perform the duties that the law dictates in terms of the levirate marriage to the widow Ruth, buying the land, marrying her, and then raising up the child in the deceased's name. That's a good point. She wanted security for Ruth, and for Orpah too, and told them to stay in the land of Moab. Okay, well, that's a good discussion. Now, let's see. Starting in verse 9, after the... And this gets us to the bottom of page 49 and then top of page 50 here in a second. The nearest kinsman removes the sandal and says to Boaz, you buy it. Now, what's Boaz say? All right, verse 9. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion or Kilian and Mahlon or Mahlon, however we say their names." Verse 10, "Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess." Here's the only verse we know, or have in the book that we know which one married the sons. We don't know it from chapter 1, but chapter 4 tells us, Ruth married Mahlon. That means Orpah had married Kilian. "I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." So this is just sort of a formality of announcing, all right, everybody saw here what happened. I'm now the nearest kinsman since he's opted out, and I am going to redeem Ruth. I'm going to buy the land, I'm going to marry Ruth, and I'm going to raise up the heir in the deceased's name so that his name not be blotted out. So he calls them all to witness. And again, a rather formal attestation, if you will, or a formal confirmation of what Boaz is willing to do on this occasion. Those that were present, verse 11, top of page 50, what did they say? All the people, and there appeared to be a crowd that had gathered there. My version says the people who were in the court, so in the surrounding area of the gate, not just the elders and not just the nearest kinsmen, but others who were there, what did they say? All right, that's what we heard it, we've seen it, and you are correct, Boaz. We are witnesses. Now, that's just a statement, but then they say something else. All right. "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home," of course, that'd be Ruth, "like who?" Now, why mention Rachel and Leah? All right. "Both of whom built the house of Israel." What do we know about the building of the house of Israel through Rachel and Leah? This is an obvious reference to what? Bearing children. Bearing children. Of those two, which one was the more... Leah bore the most children. But Rachel bore Joseph and Benjamin as well. And so this large family came. So the kind of blessing they're pronouncing on Boaz is, we hope you have what? Lots of children. We hope there are many children that come through this marriage to Ruth. So bear many children. They also say, Yes, that's where it started. Yes, that's right. Very good. Also, at the end of verse 11, may you also achieve wealth. He's already wealthy, but may this bless you. May you prosper in this union. May you become famous in Bethlehem. Verse 12, moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Charles mentioned Tamar a while ago. Why mention Perez, or Perez, in verse 12? Well, in Genesis 38, of course, that's the story with Judah and Tamar. And 1 Chronicles 2 and verse 5, Perez was an ancestor to Boaz. And apparently, in the line, he had many descendants or many offspring as well. So again, the pronouncement of the blessing here is hopefully that this new marriage will result in the beginning of a prosperous home. Many children will be born through this union. It's a pronouncement of a blessing. Let's just leave it at that. And the people here are fully supportive of this new home that's going to be started today, and hope that all goes well. All right, so the blessing of this marriage, verses 13 through 16. Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife, he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she bore or gave birth to a son. Just what was wanted. Now, for technical purposes, whose son is this? It's Mahlon's. Belongs to Mahlon. That's how he's going to be named and raised. And he'll be recognized as Mahlon's son. So that Mahlon's name not be blotted out from the records in Israel. So verse 14, woman then said to Naomi. Now notice, they're not talking to Ruth. This is very beautiful, very expressive. The women in Bethlehem, they praise Naomi. Now what does she have? What does it say? Verse 14. Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer. Who is Ruth's redeemer? Boaz. Who's Naomi's redeemer? This child. This child is. Whose name will be what? Obed. They see Obed as Naomi's restorer or as her redeemer. And may his name become famous in Israel. Verse 15. May he also be to you a restorer of life and something else. Nourisher, a sustainer of your old age or in your old age. So they want Naomi to feel blessed to have this child. The women also praise Ruth. What do they say about Ruth to Naomi? Now, how good has Ruth been to Naomi? Very well. How good, and let's think of it in the terms of the culture of the Old Testament days, how good would seven sons be? I mean, that's what they want sons over daughters, didn't they? I mean, they wanted sons. I mean, they liked their daughters too, but sons were preferable. So if a family had, if a woman had seven sons, well, she's blessed. She would be viewed as blessed by everyone else. These women say, Ruth is better to you than those seven sons. The way she's cared for you, the way she's treated you. And now she's blessed you with this redeemer, this restorer of your life, the sustainer in your old age. I tell you, Naomi, you're really fortunate to have her in your family. That's what they tell Naomi. Better than seven sons. A high compliment given the preference for sons over daughters. And again, Ruth, as we've seen in this short book, she has been so thoughtful of Naomi time after time after time, caring for her, providing for her, thinking about her, not leaving her along those lines. All right. The women brought Obed to Naomi and laid him on her lap. And verse 16 says that she became his nurse. So she's now caring for him as you would care for a new infant. And the women said to, they gave him the name Obed, saying a son has been born to Naomi. Well, of course, not literally. But Naomi is going to help raise him and nurture him as a new mother would. What were some of the things that Naomi had said earlier in the earlier chapters about her life? She says, I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. She saw nothing good in her life. What about her life now? We got any grandparents in the house? What do you think about those grandbabies when they come? Aren't they better than the ones you had? That's what I always hear. You love them because they're special to you in a way that your own children could never be. So how do you think Naomi feels about this baby now? Her heart was over as empty as she felt earlier. She's that much overflowing with happiness and love and affection now for this new child. Yes, Doug? Okay. All right, yeah, maybe she had no sense or no desire to live earlier, but now she sees a purpose. I've got this new child now that I can train and nurture and care for, and that would give her... Of course, she did have reason to live back there as well. I'm not saying she didn't, but that's how she felt. She just felt like she had nothing. And even said some things against God that... No. And sometimes when we're going through the rough spots, we can't imagine blessings that would come, but they will. God wills him to, then he can bless us, and he often does. So as the book concludes, the last section of the book, to me, this appears to be the main reason for the writing of the book. What is it that's recorded for us in these last six verses? The lineage that started with this home, eventually who comes from it? That's the main one. David comes, the greatest king in Israel, but, and of course, beyond David, more important would be the Messiah himself. Would come. Matthew chapter 1, you read the lineage of Jesus, you'll see Boaz and Naomi's name, and Obed begat Jesse, and then Jesse, of course, was David's father. That's correct. It does not go through Elimelech. It mentions... Yes, right. Okay. I think...